The slides that we're going to use tonight are up on the website, so you can feel free to look at those. Come back here. And the thrust of what we're going to see tonight is that nobody is exempt from the righteous judgment of God. Now, I have to tell you that as time has gone on, I think my understanding of this section 1 through 16 has become a bit more nuanced, and I think I've learned some things about how to explain this that I didn't know before. And I credit that to what Mott has done, L.A. Mott, as he's the author that we are basically following in our study. And so let's just talk about the first 16 verses, and we'll just start with the idea that this section is a transition section. I think now that what he does is he summarizes chapter 1 and sort of leads us into the next section, which is chapter 2, verses 17 through 29. So if this is a transition, then the question is, what's he talking about? Because this section starts with him talking about judges. And so in verse 1, he says, "Wherefore thou art without excuse," and by the way, I'm reading from the American Standard Translation. "Thou art without excuse, O man, whoever thou art that judgest. For wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself. For thou that judgest dost practice the same things." Who is this judge? Who is in this class of people that wants to judge someone else? Well, for a long time, I thought this was his introduction and the beginning of a discussion of the Jews. He had talked about the Gentiles in chapter 1, and then in chapter 2, he talks about the Jews. Now, as I said, I think my understanding has become a bit more nuanced. And I think here in this section, he's talking about the whole of humanity. He's not talking about just Gentiles. He's not talking about just Jews. He's talking about all of humanity. Now, some have suggested that the judges that he's talking about here were the Jews because they had a tendency to judge the Gentiles. And that's true. The Jews judged the Gentiles as being worse than them. But the Gentiles is not an amorphous group. There were people that were willing to be judges all over the place. Think back to the time when Judah is carried into Babylonian captivity. Well, they only carried off 10,000 of the best of the Jews. They left the majority of the Jews there in Judah. And those Jews that were left in Judah tended to look down on the ones that were carried away because their conclusion was, oh, you guys are the worst sinners. We get to stay here because we're not as bad a sinner as you are. And then when they came back under Zerubbabel and Nehemiah, they came back, but not all of the people that had been carried to Babylon came back. Some of them chose to stay in Babylon. And the people that came back looked down on the people that didn't come back. And they said, you don't care about God. You're not as righteous as we are. And then you fast forward to the New Testament. The Jews that lived in Judah looked down on Jews that lived, that were a part of what's called the diaspora or the dispersion, because there were Jews all over the world. And the Jews that lived in Judea looked down on the people that didn't live in Judea because they didn't circumcise their sons. They gave their sons Roman names. They didn't speak Hebrew. So they judged them. Now, it wasn't just the Jews who were guilty of this. The Greeks and the Romans did the same thing. I'm not as familiar with the Greek racism as I am with Jewish racism, just because I study Jewish racism more. I try to get an understanding of that. But the Greeks talked about those people that lived in Athens as being Greeks, and everybody else was a barbarian. The Romans did it. If you were a Roman citizen, you were special. Everybody else was second class. And then later, when Rome started to fall apart, they adopted the Greek habit of calling all of those Goths and Vandals that were coming into the Roman Empire from the north, they called them barbarians. So there's this long history of being willing to judge other people, and it continues today. And we have to be very careful with this idea. And I'll show you, I think, how this is going to play out. So there were judges who thought themselves to be morally superior among the Greeks and among the Jews. So some people would say, well, he's now transitioning. He's going to talk about the Jews judging Gentiles. Some people say it's not really Jews judging Gentiles. It's people that thought themselves to be morally superior that were judging people that weren't as morally upright as they were. And I think now I've reached the conclusion that this part is a continuation of what he started in the first chapter. So I think it's all men. He starts this with wherefore. And, you know, we always say, well, if you see a wherefore, that you have to look at what it's there for. He's talking about the conclusion of the argument that he's just been making. And I kind of restricted that in my prior understanding to the way that he's concluded the argument. But I don't think that's really fair. I think he's talking about, this is the conclusion of that whole argument that I was making in the first chapter. Questions, comments?
Right down there, nobody wants to hear it, but they have to hear it, but they're like,
yeah, that's the key. You hit it right on the head. It's not me, it's them that he's talking to. And I do like the way you began. They just wanted to tattle on each other. It was a tattle on everybody else. They didn't want to think about how I need to correct myself.
the judge is without excuse because of everything that's already been said. And what Ted stressed in the first chapter is that that first chapter is an indictment of humanity. So the judges are a part of humanity. And now he's going to explain why these judges are without excuse. The object of God's wrath is humankind. That's what we saw in the first chapter, right? That's who's going to suffer the wrath of God. It's not just the Gentiles. So it's the wrath that's revealed in the first chapter, and then again in the second verse. But this is a wrath that's revealed against ungodliness and unrighteousness, whether it's Greek, Jew, barbarian, the Jews who lived in Babylon, the Jews who lived in Judea, the Pharisee, it's everybody. And some thought they would be exempt. Now that's the point that Kirsten is making. Some thought, I'm not included in this judgment. It applies to Jews, but it applies to anybody who, like the Jews, were just as racist. So, this coming discussion involves a discussion that's based on understanding law. And this, again, is a little different than the way that I have diagrammed this in the past. Typically, in the past, I had the patriarchal law, and then I had the Jews coming apart from that. And both of those tracks leading down to the cross, where you had the law of Christ. Well, I think a better way to look at this is, and don't blame this on Mott, this is just me. A better way to look at this is God gave a law back in the Garden of Eden. And that law was God telling people what he expected of them. And it was for all men, right? Now, we only have the bare kind of hints at what that law was like. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Work the earth, keep it. We know that there was some sense that they had that they were not supposed to kill their brother. Okay. We don't have the record of God saying, don't kill your brother, but we know he must have. And what makes me confident that this law was given was when the Jews questioned Jesus about marriage? And Jesus said, from the beginning, this was God's expectation. A man leaves his father and mother, cleaves to his wife, the two become one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. That's all from the Eden law. Now, that law, for the most part, didn't get written down. So I'm not sure everything that was in it. But I do know there were some things there. And as I was preparing this, it occurred to me that I'm not sure that that law included a way for them to deal with the aftermath of violations of that law. Now, I know that that Cain and Abel both made sacrifices. But interestingly, I'm not sure that those sacrifices were related to sin. They may have been related to what we've been reading in the Old Testament, fellowship offerings that weren't related necessarily to sin, but it was an offering that people made to God because of the fellowship that they had with God. So, yeah, I haven't really fleshed that out yet. I'm still working on that. Yeah, Carol?
Well, didn't God make sacrifice when they got thrown out of the garden and made the the clothing out of the sacrifice that he made for their sin?
I don't know. It doesn't say that he did it for their sins. It just says he made them clothing. Okay. And the clothing was skins. And you have to conclude that probably there was an animal that was sacrificed in order for God to get the skins. But yeah. It doesn't say that it was related to their sin. They had a sense of shame, and God made them clothing to cover that sense of shame in a way. But I don't know that it restored the relationship that they had with God.
Wouldn't this be, wouldn't this indicate that they had a sense, built-in sense of conscience?
Well, they had
they knew that they had done wrong when they ate them.
Okay, hang on to that thought. We'll get there. We're going to talk about the conscience a little bit later. Okay, so hang on to that. That's a very good thought. But that conscience was related to God giving a law in Eden. Okay? And I think if you go through the book of Romans very carefully and watch what he's talking about, that's called law. It's not the law. Okay? The law in Romans, and typically throughout the rest of the New Testament, is the law that God gave through Moses. So that's the Ten Commandment law. That's the circumcision law. Okay? But that law was only given to the Jews. It wasn't given to anybody other than the Jews. And we've already seen how there were other nations that had promises. Remember we talked about a land promise and a great nation promise? What they didn't have was the Jesus part of the promise from Genesis 12. But land and nation were included in the promises made to other people beyond the Jews. So the Jews got the law of Moses, and that law brought in the idea that we could make sacrifices and we could atone for what we had done. Yeah, Bill.
Yeah, I think we mostly agree that John was in the patriarchal period. And when he offered sacrifices for his children in case they had sinned, he got that idea from somewhere.
Okay. Like I say, I've fleshed this out, and that's a good point. And I'll keep working on this. Okay. But I know the idea of atonement was advanced in what the Jews had. Okay. It may have been a part of the Eden law, but I know it was definitely a part of the Mosaic law. So you'll have to bear with me as I kind of keep working that out in my own mind. So they had the law, the Jews had the law of Moses. But in the law of Moses, right and wrong didn't change from what it was in the Garden of Eden. Okay? In the Garden of Eden, don't kill your brother. In the Mosaic law, don't kill your brother. The right and wrong stayed the same.
I think that the Jewish law given by the Lord's Sinai, that was in addition to the natural law that already existed.
The Eden law?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I think that was just an addition. That the Jews were picked out, and they had other things to do as well, like holy days and sacrificing, all kinds of laws that we know about, it, Levitical laws and that type of thing, that the normal people in the world never had to do.
Okay.
Also, I think that Paul, I think, refers to the natural law and people being judged who weren't Jews, being judged by that law.
Okay.
They're going to be judged, and you see that God in Genesis 6, he looked and said, people, they were evil conscience, and he was sorry he made them. And so he made it, what about destroy them? Because they had broken that unwritten law. Because he was talking about the whole world.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good point.
Dean?
That's good. Yeah, go ahead.
I got a question. If during the Jewish law, the people's sins through sacrifices were rolled forward, and then Christ's blood came back. Life was in the blood, so it seems to me there had to be something. We don't know what it was, but there had to be something to roll their sins forward so that Christ's sins could come back. Or am I wrong?
No, I think that's a good thought. So you have the idea of atonement or reconciliation that's a part of the old law, the part of the Moses law, but it wasn't, the sacrifices they had weren't capable of forgiving sin in the same way that Jesus' sacrifice did. It couldn't cleanse the conscience. Okay? So good point. So this is kind of my thinking at this point. Natural law or Eden law, okay, or I've seen it called ethic law. That law just said, here's what you're supposed to do. It didn't really provide much in terms of addressing what happened when you wanted to reconcile with God. It just told you what you weren't supposed to do. And when you did it, you were destroyed in the flood or subsequently in other judgments. Okay? Then the law of Moses comes along. It doesn't change right and wrong. What it added was more of a notion of atonement, more of a notion of reconciliation. Not perfected. That wasn't until Jesus comes that you perfected the idea of reconciliation or atonement. But even when Jesus comes along, he doesn't change what was right and wrong. What was right and wrong has always been right and wrong. Don't kill your brother. Moses' law, don't kill your brother. Jesus' law, don't kill your brother. Notion of right and wrong has always been there. Now, there's a series of logical propositions that I kind of put together. There was sin before the law of Moses, right? No question that there was sin back under the Eden law. It was their thoughts were only evil continually. That's why God brought the flood. So there was sin back there. But where there's no law at all, there's no sin. So there had to have been law back there before the law of Moses. Does that make sense? So then we're going to talk about how that all plays out. Okay? And we're going to talk about it in terms of judgment.
Well, there must have been law.
Right, okay.
From the very beginning, because Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, they knew no sin until Eve tempted Adam, and they both ate the knowledge of the tree of knowledge of good and evil.
Right. Right. That's my point. God had law for them. He told them what was right and wrong.
He told them not to eat of the tree, period.
Yeah, right.
He didn't list, don't murder, don't do this, don't do that. It was more.
Yeah, we don't, that part was written down. And the part about leaving your father and mother, cleaving to your wife and becoming one flesh, I know that was part of the law because Jesus said it was part of the law. I don't know where it was in the garden, but it was part of it was there from the very beginning.
But it wasn't applicable to them until they ate of the tree because they had no knowledge of sin until they received the knowledge after the taking of the tree.
It's an interesting thought. I'm going to have to think about that a little bit more. I have always thought that the knowledge that they gained about sin was a knowledge that came from participation in it. But they knew what was right. They knew not to do that. They knew it was wrong.
Yeah, because they were told,
don't do it.
So,
yeah.
As far as we're concerned, it could be, that was the original law.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, this judge in verse 1, the one that judges another, he's not claiming any kind of moral superiority. How do I know that? Because he does the things that are described in verses 18 through 22 of chapter 1. He says, thou condemnest thyself, for thou that judgest dost practice the same things. So this judge can't be claiming that I'm exempt from God's wrath because I'm morally pure. He knows he's not. And he doesn't really argue with Paul that he is exempt. His claim of exemption has to be based on somehow being special. And could be that it's not like the Gentiles because we have the law of Moses.
That's easy to do because we all feel special in our own minds.
Yeah, with that, that's it. We all think we're special. You know, the speed limit laws apply to everybody else, but not really to me. That's because I'm a safe driver. Right? I'm not gonna be all crazy about not following the speed limit laws. I follow the speed limit laws. It's those people that don't that worry me. I'm a safe driver, right? It's those guys that drive 65 miles an hour right on my front bumper that really bother me. The claim of exemption from God's wrath, as far as these judges are concerned, doesn't apply to them, and it's because somehow they think they're special. And I really like Bob's point. That's so easy for all of us to do, to think we're somehow special. Mott says this, we know that the judgment of God is according to truth. This is in his comment on verse 2. He says, and then I really like the parenthesis that he puts in there. He says, that is the facts of the case and therefore without favoritism. God's judgment is according to truth. It's what you have done. And he makes that point, the apostle makes that point in chapter 2 at verse 11, and it's inescapable. He says, there is no respect of persons with God. So all you're thinking about, you're special, doesn't apply. Because God judges everybody the same. Now, what's this judge thinking? That's verses 3 and 4. Reckonest thou this, O man, who judges them that practice such things, doest the same, that thou shalt escape the judgment of God? And then a second thought process that could be going on. Do you despise the riches of his goodness and forbearance and long suffering, not knowing that the goodness of God leads thee to repentance? So first, they might be saying, hey, we're the sons of Abraham. Remember that famous interchange that Jesus has with the Jews? They say, we're the sons of Abraham. We've never been in bondage to any man. Yeah, right. They're in bondage to the Romans right then. We've never been in bondage to any man. We're sons of Moses, sons of Abraham. That's what makes us special. And the Greek rationale, I'm not as familiar with, but the Greeks had the same kind of rationale. The second thing that they might be thinking is, and this is really dangerous, they despise God's goodness and forbearance and long-suffering, not knowing that his goodness was intended to lead them to repentance. That's 2 Peter, the third chapter, verses 9 through 15. In the last days, scoffers shall come, saying, where's the promise of his coming? Since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning. So God, the second thing that they might be thinking is, God really can't bring this wrath. He doesn't have the power or the will or something along those lines. They despise the long suffering of God, thinking that the long suffering of God meant that he couldn't do what he had promised. But he will. And Peter says, remember this, one day is 1,000 years with the Lord. When God says, I will bring wrath, he will bring wrath. So we have to know that. There's that miscalculation that got them in so much trouble. The harsh reality is judgment is coming according to what you do without any kind of favoritism. That's for all men everywhere. Verse 5, what they're doing is really just after their hardness and impenitent heart, treasuring up for themselves wrath in the day of wrath and the revelation of the righteous judgment of God. So it's like they're making deposits into a bank account. For one day, that bank account is going to come due. The basis for the judgment is the same for every man. He will render to every man, this is verse 6, he will render to every man according to his works. Jew, Greek, doesn't matter. This is judgment for all men. And I really like what Ted had to say last week. There's a final judgment, but there's a judgment that goes on every day. The way of the wicked is hard, is the way that David described it. The righteous live by faith. And when that statement is made by God to Habakkuk, that statement is, you who are righteous will live. You won't die in my judgment. It is bringing judgment from the hand of the Babylonians. That's not going to affect it. That, remember, that was Habakkuk's complaint. How can you be like that, God? There are good people, and you're going to bring judgment. It's going to affect the good people. And God says, no, the righteous will live by faith. They'll continue to exist. I'll protect them. That's the judgment that's going on every day. And some people want to say, well, that means that I'm arguing that disease is the consequence of people's sin, that AIDS is the consequence of homosexuality. I'm not arguing that at all. I am saying that if you choose a life of sin, your life will be hard. Because there's judge, you just pile up problems. I had a friend one time. His son had his car stolen for the fourth time, and Jim had to keep bailing his car out of impound. The police would find it, they'd pick it up, tow it to an impound lot, and then his son didn't have enough money to get it out of impound, so Jim had to keep getting it out of impound. Finally, he looked at him, he said, where do you park your car? He said, well, it's just around the corner from the bar. If you park your car there, it's likely going to get stolen. Don't park your car there. Okay? So it's for every man. And then Paul is going to illustrate this. And when he illustrates this, it's going to get really interesting. This is where he talks about how the people who didn't get the law of Moses knew what law was. And it's back to Ron's point about conscience. Okay? This is where it comes in. 4. That's verse 11. That's the way he introduces this section. Nobody is condemned on the basis of a law that they didn't have. Okay? God doesn't do that. But different situations call for different treatment in order that justice could be without respect of persons. Different treatment is required by judging without respect of persons. The Jews had the law of Moses, and they are condemned based on what the law of Moses said. That's verse 12. As many as have sinned without the law shall perish without the law. As many as have sinned under the law shall be judged by the law. If you got the law of Moses, it's your judgment. It's the basis for your judgment. Gentiles had the ethics law, or the Eden law, or Ron's word, natural law. Okay? And they're going to be judged by what they knew. The Gentile, this is verse 14. The Gentiles that have not the law, but do by nature the thing contained in the law, or the things of the law, excuse me, these having not the law or a law unto themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness therewith, and their thoughts one with another, accusing or else excusing them. So there are three ways that you know that the Gentiles knew what the law required of them. And it's the Eden law, okay? The first is that their conduct shows that they understand the law. They show the work of the law written in their hearts. They behave that way. That's not because they were born with it. It's because they learned it from God. Now, they probably learned it from their parents, who learned it from their parents, who learned it from their parents, who learned it from Adam. But they learned it. Second point is the conscience. Okay, now, let me skip ahead here just a little bit. Conscience. How does the conscience work? Conscience, in my way of thinking, is kind of like a carpenter's level. We're probably all familiar with a carpenter's level. You know, it's a long, has a bubble in the middle, and you put it on two things, and it tells you whether or not those two things are at the same level. Okay? That's what this guy is doing. He's holding up the carpenter's level, and he's looking at the bubble. And you can see pretty clearly in that illustration that's up there, his left hand is a little bit low. So the level, the carpenter's level, is telling him your left hand is low. Okay? But all the conscience does is measure the agreement between two things. And in this case, it's what the law says is right and wrong, and what you do. So it measures the agreement between those two things. And if what you're doing is down here, your conscience is going to tell you it's too low. Got to get it back up here. Right? But the point I want to make is your conscience doesn't tell you what's right and wrong. That's what the law does. The law lays out the standard. And the level just tells you whether that's the way you're living or not. My conscience doesn't determine right and wrong. It never can. And thankfully, God is the only one that can determine what's right and wrong. And then my conscience just measures my behavior against what God said.
Doesn't God put that determination consciously?
Yeah, your conscience, I think, and this is based on some other statements that are kind of, It's a conclusion that's based on some other statements. I think God gives you a conscience. And that conscience has a purpose. I think we're born with that conscience. But God has to give the law. That's the thing that's over here. And then you have this mechanism for measuring whether you're living up to the law or not. That's what conscience does. Okay? Now, I can wound my conscience. I can sear it. And really, all I'm doing is deciding to twist the level a little bit. So that my behavior's down here, God's law is up here. That my conscience would tell me, wait, your behavior's down too low. And I think, oh no, now I have to deal with a busted conscience. So what I'll do is I'll loosen those screws that hold the vial in a position, and I'll twist the vial just a little bit so that when it's pointed like this, the vial shows its level. And by the way, I have a level that's like that. I built a whole stairway knowing that everything was level because I was using my level. But I had a busted level. Okay. And you could step back and look at the stairs and you could see they weren't straight. And Kim, of course, pointed that out to me. And I said, yes, they are. I put the level on it. Oh, you had a busted level.
Dean? Oh,
yeah.
You sound like Saul of Tarsus, understanding of the Old Testament until he came to grips with Jesus. He was using a bubbled, a wrong level like you.
Yeah, he's using a busted level. And he says, I have lived in all good conscience until this day. Had a busted level. Okay. In fact, he really didn't have a busted level. He'd lived in all good conscience. The problem was he didn't have it resting on God's law over here. It was resting on a pebble that stuck out down here. And if you've ever used a level, you know, whenever you put the level on something, you always have to wipe it off, make sure it's clean, wipe off the surface you're trying to measure. Because if you get something on there, it distorts it. Well, that's what Paul did. He got something on there and it distorted it. His conscience worked. His level was good. Problem is, he got the law messed up. Okay? So if that's the case, then the Gentiles they didn't have the law of Moses, but they had to have something that informed their conscience. And what they had was the Eden law, or as Ron says it, the natural law, or I've called it the moral law. You look like you got a comment, Ron.
They were judged on that law when the Jews were judged, not only on that law, but also the law of Moses.
Good point.
The Gentiles judged on that law. And we're told one time God waited for mistakes.
Okay.
Not anymore.
Okay. Good point. Good point.
Dean?
So there was a law out there for those people who were not Jews, who didn't have the law of Moses.
Yeah.
And they had that law from the beginning.
Yeah, that's why I revised this illustration to try to make that clearer. That they had the Eden law. They knew what was right and wrong. Okay? That's why the judge here in chapter 2 at verse 1 is held account. It doesn't matter whether he's a Jew or he's a Gentile. You will not be able to escape because you're somehow special. That's not the way it works.
Dean?
Yeah.
Jonah went to, what was Nineveh, and they repented in sackcloth and ashes. So we know that they had law and an agreement with what was right and what wasn't.
Right, right. And when Jonah went to Nineveh, I don't know exactly what he preached, but I don't think he preached the Mosaic law. I think he preached the law that they had. Told them to get in line with the law that they had. Same thing with Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar wasn't a Jew. But God held him accountable for the way that he was behaving based on the Eden law. Okay? That's why it, and just as an aside, that's why it doesn't surprise me that the Code of Hammurabi corresponds very closely to the Mosaic law, because right and wrong is always right and wrong, no matter who writes it down.
I also think that it was built into people understood that there was a spirit of being, generally speaking. People other than the Jewish people had an indication of them, and they built things and worshiped the sun, the moon, the stars. They knew that there was some kind of spiritual being, but they didn't know how to go about it.
Right. That's what they had the Eden law. The law of Moses was a little more specific, helped them out to know more about, and now we've got the law that came through Christ, which incorporates grace, and now we really understand. Okay? Yeah, Bill.
From reading Haley's Bible Dictionary and some things I've heard of it, it's my understanding that mankind originally was monotheistic. There was one God and everybody believed that. And then they started making up other gods. And then the law came, said, I am the only God. There is only one. And that was something that was, that he was getting tired of people living the other way.
Right.
And he wanted to separate the people for himself and believe in God.
And he did. Yeah, good point. Yeah, Kirsten.
So, in the beginning, when you first interviewed this, you had said that Paul needed a new base of operations, that Rome was his new base of operations. So, is his purpose, because he wants to do what he wants them to discover, so is he basically telling them that you have this law and you have this law, but I'm bringing you all together to tell you that all of you are now going to be following this new law. So forget about what you used to know about Moses' law and what you used to know about Eden's law. I want you to follow this law.
Well, I don't think I would go so far as to say forget about what you knew from the Eden law and forget about what you knew from Moses' law, because right and wrong stayed the same. He's just saying, look, I'm telling you about something far better than what those gave you, because those didn't have redemption perfected like we have with Jesus. So if Jesus perfects redemption, don't go back there and try to find it under that law. It didn't have it.
If Paul actually talking to these people, or is this still in the letter that he wrote? Because you also said at the beginning that he sent a letter to Rome so that they can prepare for, is this still part of the letter to the people?
Yeah.
And did they just post it up? I mean, who read this letter to the people, and how did this letter spread to the people in order to say, ooh, God is coming, I want to know more?
I really don't know exactly how that would have worked, but I know something about how, remember in the book of Revelation, John gets the word of the Lord, and he sent it to the churches. And in Revelation, the indication is that he sent it by the angels of those churches. I think that's just a way of saying those, he sent it to them via a messenger. Okay.
Were those other messengers the other apostles that were in Rome?
No, I think Paul just sent the letter, and I don't know how it got there. But remember, Paul had some traveling companions, so he may have sent this letter ahead and said, when you get there, read it. Now, you probably couldn't just nail it on the door of the synagogue and tell everybody to read that thing, because for the most part, they were illiterate. So you had to have somebody read it for them so that they could understand it. Yeah, Lenny.
Paul sent the letter to Rome to introduce himself.
Yeah.
So that when he arrived, they would know of him and listen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want you to understand what I've been preaching so that when I get there, you can help me. Because they wouldn't help him if they didn't know what he was preaching. So he wanted them to know for sure what he was saying, so that when he got there, they would help get him on his way. Yeah, Bob.
I always thought that letters like written to Corinthians and different groups like that would have been read by the elders, because there was congregation with elders in it. And there'd be a lot of people, I'm sure, in a congregation that couldn't read or write.
Yeah. And I would like to think that the elders could, but I don't know that they could. There might have been...
Yeah, the Holy Spirit working in a congregation. We don't know when it was.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So they may have had a miraculous ability to have read the letter, even if they were illiterate. That's a good point. But they may have had somebody in the church that knew how to read. And so he would read the letter. But it might have been one of the elders. It might have been one of the deacons, might have been one of the teachers.
Remember Paul and his letter to the Colossian church. And he said, after you get done reading this, take it to the Laodicea and read it to them.
Yeah.
Share it with them.
Yeah. Yeah. But to answer Kirsten's question, I think what he was doing was saying, I want you to have a real good understanding of what I teach, so that you can be confident in me and you can help me to teach this. And I think that's something that we have to be concerned about, because frankly, the church here gets requests from preachers all the time who are saying, help me preach the gospel, and you don't know them. And you don't know what they mean by help me preach the gospel. So sometimes you look around for somebody like Barnabas who says, oh, I know them, and I can tell you what they teach. Sometimes it's in our best interest to say to someone, Nolan, I want, you know, this guy is, he needs help, or he wants us to help him preach in Africa. Nolan, you have the time. We want to send you to Africa to talk to this guy to find out what he teaches. Or we might send Lenny or Ron, you know. Well, we might say, hey, Africa, there's a lot of diseases in Africa, and I'm not sure I want to expose people that are a little older to some of those diseases. So we'll find a healthy young specimen that we can send over to Africa. Okay. So I only say that because I think it's important for us to know what we're supporting. And I think that's why Paul writes this letter, so they'll know what he's asking them to support. Does that answer your question, Kirsten?
Yeah.
I hope. Maybe more than you wanted. And that's okay. That's okay. She comes to Breakfast Club and she's got a notebook. And that's great. I love it. Yeah, Dean.
Well, I was listening to the Kirsten's question, and I've been kind of sitting back here listening. We talk about the Qigong, we talk about the Wahdi movies, and we almost talk about them like they're two different things. But you, like you keep saying, right, wrong, wrong. With God, God's plan was simple. Love me, love your name. So really, what this is all kind of coming to in my simplistic way is, you go to somebody's house and you play rummy. And at the Giles house, the rules for rummy are this way, and at the Anderson house, the rules for rummy are this way, and at somebody else's house, the rules for rummy are this way, and they become convoluted over time. What Paul's doing is what the person who invented rummy is saying, this is how it's supposed to be. So you're not right. You're not right. In all of your concentrated effort to do it a certain way, you've been missing the mark. So the Jews have been missing the mark. They've been misunderstanding what their purpose was. And the Gentiles have been missing the mark because they've been allowing other things to come in, and they've been coming up with ways to worship God. And Paul is slapping everybody and saying, look, here's the rule sheet. This is how it works. We're all going to play this together, and if we don't play it right, we'll lose. So, I mean, that's just the way my little key brain works. I have to break it.